Okay. Chasing the Wind is a reference to back to letter B on the previous page, the 11 vanities that left Solomon empty. We spent more time talking about human pleasure, human labor, human rivalry, human greed, human fame, human wealth, human coveting, human foolishness, and human awards, or rewards, excuse me. Those are the nine that we emphasized. But he wanted to enlarge a little bit upon the first two in that list. And so the remainder of the lesson is taken up with the vanity of human existence and the vanity of human wisdom. So, if you will, turn back to chapter 1 in verse 3. And let us reread that first section, verses 3 through 11. Chapter 1, verses 3 through 11. Would someone like to read that for me? Patsy, thank you.
What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away, another generation comes. But the earth abides forever. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. Wind goes toward the south, turns around to the north. Wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after.
Thank you. I thought it interesting that 10th verse when it said, he said, is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? And I think that some would say, well, obviously that's the case. There are new inventions every day, new things that come about. But they're all derivative of what has already been in existence. I mean, you take, for example, innovations in transportation. Well, we've been transporting forever. It's first on foot. Now we can do it by a rocket, I guess. But still, the same process takes place. But the application, I think, that is primary is with regard to man's existence. We talk about things which bring happiness, joy, things that bring sadness, the way men act with other men, the physical calamities that have been present forever, all of the things that impact us in our lives. There's not anything really new that exists. It's all as it has always been. And that's the point that he's making here, is that continual repetition of physical life. And so, of course, as we remember the fact that we're discussing this in light of a point of view where we're seeking value, intrinsic value just in those things without respect to God, it is not surprising that when you read what Patsy read in this list, that it is something that ultimately is recognized as being vain. We talk about weather, for example, in this text. I was listening to a meteorologist on, I don't remember what channel it was on, but he was talking about the hurricanes that were coming in and the how people were talking about Irma as being something no one's ever seen before. And he said it's interesting that when Irma finally hit the Florida coast, it was a Category 3 hurricane. And the hurricane back in the 1920s that hit the coast was much more strong than Irma was. He said what people were talking about as far as Irma being such a strong storm, that was out in the ocean when they were measuring it, which you couldn't do back in the 1920s. In other words, we're seeing more information early on, but what they saw back then always is just what it was like when it actually hit. And it wasn't as strong a storm as others that had happened. So, you know, we had those kinds of views, and people talk about that, new things that are happening. We have, I think, a prejudice of place and time to where, because it's impacting us, because we're the ones experiencing it, it seems to be unique in some way, when in reality, this is the way it's always been. And men have been impacted, whether it be that example of weather or other types of calamities, or man's inhumanity to man. But it's just a repetitious thing. One generation rises, that generation dies off, another generation replaces it, and there's no real change. When I preach on this particular book, often I'll use the word nihilism as an explanation, ultimately, of life lived under the sun. I point out the fact that there are an awful lot of humanists that are in the world today that are very much individuals of conviction, the idea that they will be able to change the world. They're very idealistic with regard to their views of things. That, you know, if we can just shrug off the shackles of religion and superstition, and we can act rationally and behave rationally, we can make a difference. And this generation's going to do it. And so they go the entire of their lives trying to make the world better. And then they come to the end of their life, and again, an atheist, a humanist, one who's living life under the sun, he doesn't think about what will come after death. So he gets to the end of his life, or near the end of his life, and looks back on the life that he lived, the changes he sought to make, and he sees that the world is just the way it was before. And so his idealism and his optimism of his youth gives way to despair. Because if this is all there is, and I spent my entire life trying to make a difference, and there really has been no change at all, it's the same as ever been, then I've wasted my life. And that's what nihilism ultimately is a philosophy of despair that has its point of view, life that is lived without respect to God. And so I think that you can say that the point of view of Ecclesiastes, as Solomon was writing it, was nihilistic. He tried everything thinking that there would be a change, there would be something of value, and turns out there wasn't. And that's what physical existence, which is, again, an introductory thought. We're at the very beginning of the book here. So we're talking about life in general and the explanations that are given here. So you'll look at the points that are found under letter A. First of all, verse 4. One generation passes away, another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. So this has reference to that cyclical nature. And he uses a newspaper. You know, there are still some in existence, even though many of us don't read them anymore. But, you know, there's one that has the announcements of births, one section of the paper, and then there is another section of the paper that has the obituaries. And that's the way it is every single day, and that's the way it has been for centuries. It just is the same old in that regard. And so we talked about this a little bit last week, but it's hard for us to get in our mind that after our death, life goes on. And even those we are closest to, that they continue to exist, that the idea of self-importance, that a conceit that we all have to one extent or another, is something that is a vain concept. So the futility of life cycle is mentioned there in verse 4. In verse 5, he mentions what he declares, and I like this phrase, the monotony of Solomon's tone here. The same rut over and over. The sun rises, the sun goes down, hastens to the place where it goes. Wind goes toward the south, turns around to the north, blows about continually. The rivers run into the sea, yet the sea's not full. To the place from which the rivers come, they return again. And he's talking about nature now, the existence of the physical universe, but the monotony of that. It's just over and over and over and over. Which leads him in verse 8 of the text to say that all things are full of labor. And he mentions wearisome. And that's actually in the center column, center reference of my New King James Version. It's all things are wearisome, monotonous, full of labor. Man cannot express it. So looking at this, there are those things that are mentioned. This is the futility of life cycle, the same rut over and over. He also mentions in verse 8, in the last part of it, the eye not being satisfied with seeing nor the ear with hearing. So that would have a reference within this physical existence, our desire to find something. And all of the other things that are mentioned in that list on page 2 are subsets of that something. So what am I looking for something? The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear with hearing. I'm trying to figure out something that's going to make me happy. I'm going to look for that and seek it. I'm going to listen for it. I'm going to look for it. And no matter what it is that we turn our eye to or we pay attention to, it doesn't give any ultimate happiness or lasting happiness to us if we're living without God in the picture. And he makes a point with regard to the latter part of verse 8 concerning the fact that it's not enough simply to see something once. And I'm not sure if that's the primary point being made in this particular section of text, but it is an interesting one. He points out here is that if you, and you might think to yourself, if only I could, if only I could go to Alaska and see the Aurora Borealis, if only I could climb to the top of Mount Everest and look out over the world from the highest point, if only I could do this, if only I could do that, then I would be satisfied. And in reality, it doesn't work that way. And even if it is something that you rejoice in and it is everything that you expected it to be, then next year you want to do it again. You want to go back and do it again because those kinds of things do not ultimately give lasting satisfaction. We're not saying with regard to any of this, and Solomon's not saying with regard to any of this, that there's not some value with regard to these things. We know that there's value in hard work. We know that there's value in learning things. We know that there's value in having money. There are good things that could be done with the money that you have and uses for that. So all of these kinds of things, there is some good that comes. There can be some momentary joy that comes as you experience these things or as you utilize these things. But what we're talking about is lasting value. And that's not present in any of these physical things. And that's the point that he's wanting to make here in this particular text. So, if you go to page 4, you'll notice that he also mentions verse 9. Again, the same concept here, verse 9, which says, that which has been is what will be, that which is done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. There's no breaking news. History repeats itself over and over and over again. And it is because of that, if that all is all that there is, that's the tragic nature, the vain nature of that. And so while we again understand that that's not true, and Solomon from time to time in the book, and especially in his conclusion of the book, shows that that's not true, that is how people live their lives. The majority of people live their lives. I was talking with Donna Craig, and I think I mentioned this maybe from the pulpit last week. I know that I said it publicly. But the conversation that I was having with her was about Joanna having to work on Sunday on occasion. I think on Sunday nights, every once in a while, she has to work. And she wanted off. And she said, I need to be at church. And her boss told her, he said, well, everybody wants to go to church on Sunday. But not all of us can. And if everybody did, then wouldn't be open. You know, that was the idea. And I don't remember if Donna actually told him this or Joanna actually told the boss this. But that's not so. It's not true. You know it's not true. It's obvious when you're sitting in the, you know, you pull out after Sunday morning after services and you see, you know, tons and tons of cars going by, people who aren't dressed for Sunday worship, and you know that there are most of the people in the world just don't have a concern or interest in spiritual things. That's the way most people live their lives. They live their lives in a way that's vain. Now, they may be in the middle of their testing. See, this is what Solomon was doing. He tried it all. He looked for it all. And he would go and say, okay, maybe this is where it is. And he would look and try to find value in it. And then he would come to a realization, no, that's vain. So he'd try something else. And I think that there are a lot of people that are still in the midst of that. How many times have you had someone who's walked in services and said, you know, I'm unhappy. I'm unfulfilled. I've been trying it this way, but now I'm looking for something different, something better. And so they finally come to the Lord to look for that. And if indeed they're sincere and persistent, it's the seed falling on good soil, then they find that value. But so many in the world are still in the midst of looking for it somewhere else. And so there's a great deal of vanity that is found in that. So that's the way most people live. And Solomon basically is saying this, I've already tried it, learn from my mistakes so that you don't have to repeat them yourselves. And that's really what the premise of the book of Ecclesiastes is about. All right, I do this. I have a tendency to talk too much. So does anyone have any questions or life experiences or insights about the idea of just this general concept of the cyclical nature of life lived under the sun? Vanity of it.
I've always found it kind of comforting in that, as far as people's behavior, lots of times we like to say, well, that's just unbelievable. But now we kind of, you realize, no, there's nothing under the sun. That's believable that people behave that way. And it's kind of helped me live my life in the way that, to handle it. There's not that shock factor to life anymore. And so it doesn't make us crumble and doesn't crush us because of behaviors.
Whenever difficult or bad things happen, it can be overwhelming when we think that it's uniquely our experience.
Yes.
Like nobody else in the world has ever had this happen to them
right.
in reality. And you know, that's something.
But generically, I'm talking about
society as a whole. Right, big picture. That's exactly so. But I think it's also helpful as we bring it in specifically. And the thing that comes to my mind is the loss of a loved one, especially a spouse, and how that impacts you. And everyone will ultimately experience that kind of thing. It's something that happens. It doesn't mean that it is any less powerful. But what we're talking here is about maybe some perspective that will help us, enable us to handle it a bit better than what we otherwise would. Because it always feels like nobody could hurt like this,
right.
as much as I've heard it. But
questions of life. Yeah. People have asked them forever. And so we know that we're not alone in those things.
Good. Anybody else? All right, then the second section of our study then is with regard to the desire for wisdom. And so, of course, we recognize that Solomon had wisdom. He sought to learn things. There's a text, let me see where it is at, 1 Kings 3, if you'll turn to 1 Kings, the third chapter. You'll remember that when David died, that Solomon as a young man felt very unprepared to serve as king. And so God offered him whatever it is he felt that he needed. And verse 5 is where it begins. He says, "In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. God said, 'Ask, what shall I give you?' Solomon said, 'You have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth and righteousness and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him. You have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. Now, Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I'm a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this great people of yours?'" And so that is the wisdom that he wished for. And of course, that request that he made was something that was granted by God. And it was an important thing. So again, we see something that has intrinsic value. And benefit by being wise. He had ability to discern that others might not have, and to discern the right course, to discern good and evil. One of the things that I think is interesting when you look at the life of Solomon, how that wisdom did not keep his heart from turning away from God. And you wonder somewhat about that. If here's an individual who has the ability and knowledge to discern what is right and what is wrong, and he has that wisdom to make that discernment, then if he was being honest with himself in his life that he lived, he knew that the choices that he was making were not right choices. And that's something to be kind of considered. When you talk about an individual sinning, some people sin out of ignorance. They don't know that what they're doing is inappropriate or wrong. When an individual, though, comes to the point where he is made aware of the wrongness of what he's doing, then there remains a choice to be made. So, okay, I know it's wrong. Am I going to continue persist in doing this wrong, or am I going to turn away from that and start doing right, living like I should? And it's amazing how often individuals who know better still persist in doing things that are wrong, things that they ought not do. So wisdom in itself is good and important. We need to gain insight. We need to pray for wisdom. But it's still a matter of will or choice as to how we live our lives. And that's the peculiar thing about Solomon, because he knew, and yet he determined that he was going to try to find something else, look for something else, do something different. And wisdom is one of the things that he tried. Now, this idea of wisdom, I think it's really easy to conflate wisdom with knowledge. So, you know, knowledge is the actual knowing of facts. Wisdom is the right and proper application of those facts. But even in Scripture, you'll find that the word wisdom and the word knowledge, they are sometimes very much interrelated and almost used interchangeably. So ultimately, when you look at what is said in going to there, Ecclesiastes 1, verses 12 through 18, he said, verse 13, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This is a burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. Indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. So there's the two together. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I perceive this also as grasping for the wind. So in this phrase, there is tied in with this concept the search for knowledge, which is a pursuit that many people have. There are a lot of people who know a lot that are not particularly wise. They don't make the proper applications of the things that they do know. But the two are very much tied together. So I want to know, and I want to be able to perceive, and I want to grasp the intricacies of life and why things are the way they are, and why people act the way that they do. And there, again, is some value in that. Elders, for example, are men who are older, who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern good and evil, and as such they are qualified to serve as overseers. They have wisdom within them. They need that. You don't want to have a man serving as an elder who is not a wise man. Wisdom is something that is beneficial and helpful in all circumstances, but the pursuit of wisdom as an end to itself is something that is a vain pursuit. Now, the question is, why is that? So, look at what he says. Maybe you have some that you could add to it. Number one is that if the idea is to pursue knowledge and wisdom, to know everything, we can't. So there's some vanity in that. The idea that I'm going to reach the point to where I know all, of course, is something that's not true. Have you ever watched Jeopardy and seen individuals who just seem to know everything? I mean, sometimes you got those characters that are so smart. But the thing is, even though those questions may seem difficult to you, they still are surface questions in that particular subject. In other words, questions that someone who really has a encyclopedic knowledge of that particular small topic, they would know that easily. There's nothing that's particularly arcane or esoteric about what's being asked. And it becomes obvious when you get to a topic that you know. So there's something that you've studied. And some of you may have seen this experience with regard to Bible. When they ask Bible questions, the Bible questions are almost always easy to answer if you've studied the Bible. And the interesting thing about it is some of these geniuses that you're hearing answer all these questions, you have no idea what they're talking about. When it comes to a Bible question, they don't know it. Well, I know that one. That's a simple one. Of course, it was Adam and Eve, or you know, whatever the case may be. But what that means is that you have individuals who are kind of the Renaissance people. You know, in other words, they enjoy learning things, and so they read maybe voraciously. They have interest. Anything interests them, and so they have a lot of knowledge about a lot of different subjects. But still, they don't have that encyclopedic knowledge that a specialist would have in his particular narrow realm of study. And then you might have a guy that knows almost all there is to know about one particular thing, but he's completely ignorant of everything else. So there's two ways of approaching knowledge, but the point is you can't know everything about everything. It just doesn't work that way. and those who are pursuing that for that purpose, then that's vanity as well. The second thing, and that's actually down in number three, the second thing that makes this vain is that the more you learn, the more of a headache it is. That wisdom and knowledge is something that also brings grief. And I think, again, that's something that we know. When we see the ignorance of a small child and the bliss of a small child, and we don't have that same bliss that they have because we know better than they do. We know what's out there. We know what's going to come. We know how hard life is. That we recognize the vanity of that as well. Now, the other thing he says in point two in that paragraph is as we've talked about quite a bit, we're not saying that there's something wrong with or no intrinsic value in education or learning. Those things are important. But ultimately, when it comes to the end of life, if you want to have a good life that has an ultimate purpose, then it's not to be found in the pursuit of knowledge. It's got to be something else. All right. Questions, comments about that section? Go a little more quickly today, but anybody at all? All right, so look at the two bullet points at the bottom of the page four. I've got them both starred. I think they both are points that are worth relating. Number one, if there's nothing new beneath the sun, our only hope must be above the sun. It's a good way of putting it. And remember, under heaven, under the sun, that's a phrase that Solomon is using. So he's looking for things without God in the picture. And so look above the sun, beyond the sun. If Solomon had everything visible, and he did just about, he had all the women that he wanted, he had all the money that he wanted, he had all the fame he wanted, he had all the knowledge that he wanted. All those things are visible, and there was not value ultimately to be found in that. Happiness, lasting happiness was not there. Well, then, ultimate lasting happiness must come from something invisible rather than visible. And that's what we call for. But it's a hard, hard thing, and it's a hard thing to convince others of. So you're going your way, and you are living a life that is Spartan relative to the hedonism that you see in the world today. So people are imbibing and involving themselves in any excess that they want. They do what they want. They take what they want. And you're refraining. You don't engage in those activities. Why? The only reason why is because God said not to. So they look at you, and they're having fun, and they look at you not having fun, and they ask themselves the questions, why would I want to have the life that you have? Why would I want to keep these things from myself, not enjoy these things that are here? And the only way to convince them that your way is the best way is if you can get their eyes beyond the sun. So that's our challenge. It's our challenge whenever we come and talk to those who are out in the world. That's our challenge in raising our children, is to get them to focus on eternity. And Peter talked about that in 2 Peter 1 when he talked about short-sightedness, even to blindness, forgotten you were purged from your old sins. Individuals and these are Christians in this consideration, 2 Peter 1, but they get their mind off of eternity and off of heaven, and it's on the earth now. And they're thinking about earthly things and worldly things, and they forget that because they're so involved in what's right in front of them, and they lose their soul. If you keep your focus on eternity, you don't lose your soul. If you don't, you do. And that's the real problem that we have. So any insight that you can give me as to how to convince someone to look up above the sun, please share it with me, because it is a difficult thing to do in the world today.
I do think if we're only teaching our children and other people outside the world that it's only about heaven, that does maybe sell our faith a little short. I love what he says about our only hope must be above it. So if our hope is above the sun, that makes what's below the sun even brighter to me.
Sure.
God's creation. And so I think knowing that God is love, and I know we hate to say those things sometimes because we don't want it to sound like we're being about the social positive gospel and that kind of thing, but I think that people have to see it's that our wisdom has shown us, too, that those things that they think are fun really can be dangerous to you physically on this earth here,
okay.
And that we don't find those things to be rewarding at all, because they're not pleasing to our Father, for one thing, on earth.
Right.
Where, so it's not always about what our reward is.
Right. So, yeah. That's a good point to be made.
So, is the whole
and it brings us back to this question that I'm asking, we'd like some insight on. And I've got some views and some ideas about it as well. But we know that to be the case. If we're living faithfully for the Lord, we recognize that life is better even on earth as we live for Him. I think that's something that we would acknowledge. But how? What can we do to show that to other people? We can tell them that.
Our light shines and it just reflects it.
Okay, I think that's the point. Is the way we conduct ourselves. So how is it that not just what you tell people, but how you present your people? Do you present to people? Do you present yourself as a fulfilled individual? Do you present yourself as a happy individual? Someone who's getting joy out of life. Something who truly not only states that his burden is light, but who shows that the lightness of burden by the life that he lives. Because I think that sometimes we can come off, I've mentioned this before. I've talked to a number of really, really strong Calvinists, individuals that are fully convinced in the sovereignty of God, that indicates that man has absolutely no choice, that choice is an illusion, that there is absolutely nothing that man can do to determine his destiny, and that fatalism leads to a very grim outlook. You know, if I'm saved, I'm saved. I'm lost, and they're just very dour and grim in their treatment of life. And you know, when you see people like that, and you see that kind of theology, I wonder sometimes why anybody would be in any way attracted by that. It's just, but I think that sometimes we as Christians can be the same way. When parents are telling their children, no, you can't do that. Why? Because God said so. You know, and you know, that kind of thing. That maybe our children don't have that full understanding. But if they see a parent, a mom and a dad that are living, loving for one another, certainly, and so they've got a full family life, and they're joyful, and they're looking forward to services, and they rejoice, they're singing songs of praise to God, all of those kinds of things are present, then it becomes real to the child. And it's something that is attractive. And so now the child can see that there is a greater brightness and glory and happiness that is in this life as well as you look to eternity. And that's certainly true. So when we look at this picture of life lived under the sun, he's giving a very bleak description. But he does talk about getting joy out of life throughout the text and the good of things. Rejoice in your youth, for example. Enjoy living as a young person before you start getting old and it's harder to live in the same way and to enjoy it as much. It's, you get up in the morning and you're aching all over. It's a little different than when you were 20. And so enjoy it while you've got it. Those kinds of things are there, but it always needs to be within that context of God's existence. All right? Okay. Anything else? Let us then go to the digging deeper discussion questions. Some of these we might spend a little bit more time than others on. But the first question is, if you could wish for anything, what would it be? Wow. Anybody want to answer that? Okay, so Solomon, he did that. He had the chance to wish for anything. So he wished for wisdom. What did God give him, by the way, when he wished for wisdom? He gave him everything, didn't he? Wisdom and fortune. Nothing was kept back for Solomon.
But he was wise, and just, you know, he was a little child, and to ask wisdom, I mean, that was wise. Is that wise?
Well, yeah, sure. It was a fortuitous choice, and I think that there are times in our own lives when we feel overwhelmed. I think that's what was happening at that time. The greatness of the task before him, and following the or filling it in the shoes of his father David, king of Israel, was something that was overwhelming to him, and he realized that he didn't have the ability to do that. So,
well, that's wisdom there.
Yeah. So that okay. So there's something to be said for that ability to recognize your inadequacies. So,
he was a child. You know, he would have wished for $1 million. You know, whatever, or toys. You know, whatever children wish for, but he didn't wish for wisdom.
How old was Solomon when he became king?
Yeah. I thought he was a king when he asked.
He said a little child. He just
Yeah, and that's how he described himself. He described himself as a little child there in the text.
That would be comparative.
I think it is, too. I think it's just talking about it being a novice and his inexperience. I think, I'm trying to remember. He was he was a very young man, for sure. But I don't think he was literally a little boy.
Comparing himself to David?
Yeah, and the lack of experience and the lack of knowledge and wisdom. Yeah.
What verse are we reading where he says
it's there in 1 Kings chapter 3.
Oh, in 1 Kings.
Yeah, sorry.
Verse 7.
Okay. Yeah, because when you get into in chapter 1 and down in verses 12 and following, that's after the case, after the fact. So I don't know exactly. I'd have to go back and do some research as to what. We won't know his exact age, but he was a young and inexperienced man, certainly. There is something to be said for being self-aware, and to acknowledge our weaknesses and our lacks, so that we can gain that. So here's a good. Just I'm trying to figure out why we would ask that question, and. Of course, whenever you have someone else who wrote the book, it's sometimes difficult to ascertain.
Question.
A little bit. So, I mean, because what are we all going to answer? What do you want to wish for? I want to go to heaven. Yes, okay, so we all got that.
Maybe
there's this lesson to be found in this, because we find there in that example given there in 1 Kings that Solomon asked for something that was commendable in wisdom, and yet we find now that in and of itself was not sufficient. It was vain in and of itself. And so I think maybe the lesson here is, no matter what it is that we ask for, if God's not in the picture, that's ultimately not something that's going to give us the lasting value we desire. So I could wish for health. I could wish for the protection of my family. All those kinds of things are things that are beneficial and helpful, but ultimately, anything other than wishing that I'll be saved and that I can save as many as possible, and maybe my family members as well, anything else is such a lesser value thing as to be relatively unimportant. And that's the point that's being made there.
I think I would wish for applied wisdom. Know how to apply wisdom.
But isn't that what wisdom is?
Applied
knowledge.
Yeah.
That's kind of okay. So you wish for applied wisdom.
Don't try to understand it. Just say, okay, number two.
and then you can wish for the ability to properly apply applied wisdom, and then you'd really be getting it. But yeah, those things are important. All right, so question number two. Although warned by Solomon that fame and fortune doesn't equate with happiness, people continue down the same road. List of sad celebrities is endless. Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Michael Jackson. It's kind of interesting. You see what generation a person is by who they mention. Because there are others who would demonstrate that some of our young people would know. Can anybody think of who that might be? Kurt Cobain? Anybody know who Kurt Cobain is?
He's even older, Stan.
Older than who?
I mean, he would be in our generation.
Right. Well, I'm talking about my
generation.
Hey,
he's young.
Marilyn Monroe died long before. Who's Kurt Cobain? Kurt Cobain.
He's my age.
Sorry.
Kurt Cobain. He was the lead singer for a rock and roll group called Nirvana. Grunge rock. You ever heard of grunge rock? Anyway. So he's Robin Williams, someone recently. Yeah, I just get that. You hear about people who I can't remember who it was, but I actually heard this in a funeral that I went to a long, long time ago, and the person who was in that who was being eulogized was liked to play the guitar, and the preacher, and I believe it was a Baptist preacher, basically said he's up in heaven playing guitar with Elvis. Use that as an example.
That's incentive.
Yeah. So, and you think that, okay, well, is he actually up there, and is Elvis really up there? So,
but, oh, he better be.
The Gallman family likes Elvis. We are all aware of that. So these are individuals that we're talking about who are rich and famous and very much unhappy. So that's one of those things to kind of utilize if you're trying to talk to people. I'm tired of living, trying to live as a Christian. I want to do what I want to do. Okay, where does that end up? Where does that lead? And you see examples of this, both well-known and perhaps lesser-known. I've had opportunity to talk to Terry and Carla Parvin. He's an elder there at the church in Mansfield, and his wife, and was preacher at Haltom City. And he lost his son. His son became addicted to drugs and died of a drug overdose is actually what he died of. And they lost him. And you know, the pain that when I went to the funeral that he expressed, he stood up in the building and talked. And he was talking to not only the Christians who were there, who were giving comfort to the family, but all of the friends of this young man who had died, which was the group of people that he was running around with who were participating in that lifestyle with him. And I know why he did what he did, but it was hard to imagine him being able to do it. He stood up there and talked about the fact that his son had left the Lord. And though he prayed for mercy, he understood the end of those who are disobedient to God, and just wanted everyone to understand and recognize how destructive the drug use and the culture was that he had involved himself in, and to have the strength to stand up and say that. And he said it to a bunch of people who were sitting in the back that had, you know, tattoos and shaved heads and piercings all over the place and that kind of stuff, that didn't want to hear what he had to say. So it was a very appropriate thing for him to say. But just understanding how destructive those kinds of things are. And that's where people are looking for something to fill them, and it just can't be found there. And so it's a very destructive thing. So that's an example of what we're talking about. So with that, the question is, what advice would you give someone as to the secret of happiness and satisfaction? As if we've not talked about this, but does anyone have any insight they want to share with us? I've kind of been the topic of the entire study.
I put down four things, but I don't know if it's...
Well, then tell me the four things.
Put God first in your life.
Okay.
Put your family second in your life. Work third and pleasure fourth.
Okay. So you're talking about priorities then?
Priorities.
And having the proper priorities. Good.
I've added be humble in doing all those things.
Okay. Humility.
I think you have to have I don't know how I would describe it, the love you have to have for God. In order to do what she says, you have got to love him more than we can even imagine. And I don't know how you help somebody to learn to love God, especially if they haven't done it from their youth, someone who's left the Lord. Of course, they should know, but even taking a person in the world, how do you show them? They can read, and that's the first thing you probably need to do. But how do you get that love for the Lord?
Well, yeah, that's a difficult question. You think about it, because instruction is basically what the Bible is. It instructs us to do that. I think that we note that when such instruction is given, that instruction falls upon a particular type of heart, a good heart, a shallow heart, a heart that's with the cares in the world, and then the heart that's the hard heart. You know, those are the soils that are mentioned in the seed for the sower. And so there, I think, has to be something that is within a person.
I do too. I think it in order has to be accepted. There.
In fact, that just as a point, because this is very, very difficult, we all have a tendency to blame ourselves when someone else goes bad. So the idea is, okay, well, I know I've taught them, but what did I leave undone? And I think sometimes we need to acknowledge and understand that maybe there was nothing left undone, that there was something that was lacking within that person with regard to their heart. Now, the word can touch the hearts of men. It can change the hearts. It pierces the heart. It divides the heart. So those things can happen. But ultimately, there's got to be a willingness on the part of the person. And I think it is a matter of will. So I'm not going to say that some people are going to go to hell because they were created without that something in them that needs to be there. But I do think that circumstances, willfulness, Romans 1 talks about individuals who pursued these debased things to where God gave them over to the debased mind. They no longer retain God in their knowledge, and because of that, they became depraved. So it's a process. And that's why it's so important when we're raising our children to inculcate in them this love for the Lord, the realness of God, while they have young, tender hearts, so that it will take. And but ultimately, there is something to be said in why God holds each individual responsible for the person themselves and what's within or not within them as far as their response to it. Because you can't, and this is something I know as a preacher, I preach a lesson, and you know, some men are more eloquent than I am, and some people are better at making that emotional appeal. But every once in a while, as I say, I wax an elephant. At least I feel myself, I'm waxing eloquent. I'm really getting it out there, and I get emotional, and it's there, and it's you know, in my mind it's resounding. And some people come up to me and say that was an awesome lesson, and then other people were not touched by it at all. How could you not be touched by that? Because it touched me. So different people are different, and we have to understand that. We do what we can, but ultimately each individual is responsible. So, you know, giving them the instruction, giving them the example, as Tracy said, to where they see the realness of it in your life and the joy that's there and how wonderful it is. If you can speak about that, don't assume that your children know how happy it is that you are a Christian. Mom, why are you smiling? Because I'm thinking about the Lord. I'm thinking about heaven. I'm excited about going to worship. Or, you know, those kinds of things where they can see that in you, that enthusiasm and that love and joy.
As I look back, that's where I think I fell short, was assuming that they were getting what they needed and that they understood, and maybe it wasn't expressed as much as it should.
I think we all leave things left undone in those situations. Yeah. Anybody else about that question? We got about 7 more minutes. Maybe we can get through all the questions. Maybe not. It doesn't matter. We're not in a big hurry. Okay, question number 3. Why will the selfish person who says, "What's in it for me," never be satisfied?
They can't get beyond themselves.
Okay. Good.
Which is where selfishness is.
Acts 20:35 says it's more blessed to give than receive.
Yeah, that's it. A person who is basically, you're focused inwardly. Yeah. When you focus so inwardly, you forget the joy that comes from that outward focus on other people.
And don't expect anything in return when you do things for others.
I do think that question 3 and question 4 kind of go together. Is a part of this. There's that inward focus, but also the way that physical things are is you're never satisfied with what you have, because there's always something beyond that that is even better, even newer, even more valuable, and challenging those kinds of things. So the question number 4 is, enough is never enough. Man never earns enough. Woman's never beautiful enough. Our stuff's never nice enough. Like the cow with his head through the fence, we yearn for greener pastures. So, would someone read for me Philippians 4:11, what Paul learned in regard to contentment? Philippians 4:11 and 12.
Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need.
And where was he when he wrote that?
Prison.
In prison, yeah. He was in prison when he said that. Okay, so how do you learn that? He says, I have learned in whatever state I am to be content.
Trust in God.
Okay. So he's got the idea of life's not lived under the sun. The ultimate reward is out there. it comes with wisdom and age, maturity is a part of it.
He endured a lot. He endured a lot all the time.
When you think about what he, why he experienced what he experienced. In other words, when the Lord appeared to him on the road to Damascus and said, "I'm Jesus whom you're persecuting," and his answer was, "What do you want me to do, Lord? Go, it'll be told you what you must do. You're going to become a vessel for me." He took seriously that charge. As much as in me, I'm ready to preach the gospel. So he went full out in serving the Lord. There wasn't any hesitation on his part. He didn't hold anything back. And it cost him an awful lot. It cost him, he said, "I counted everything as refuse, as trash, that I may win Christ and be found in him." So that's what he did. And as he did that, he found himself to be happy, joyful, content. He tried it, in other words. I think a lot of this is experiential. Someone looks at it from the outside and they think, "I don't see how that could be a happy life. I don't see how that could be a fulfilling life." And they never give themselves over to it. And I think ultimately that's what the Apostle Paul did, that's very similar to what Solomon did. Solomon tried everything. And everything that he tried, he found didn't have value. And he came to the conclusion that what man's all is serving God, keeping his commandments. Well, Paul tried serving God and keeping his commandments. And he saw the value in it. He experienced what a wonderful thing it is. And he persisted in it. And so even during the difficult times in his life, and they were many, as 2 Corinthians 11 shows us, or that litany of things that he suffered for Christ, that regardless of all those horrible things that he suffered, he still had the ability to be content in the darkest times and have that overriding peace and joy that we have because we're his.
And happiness is not ha-ha all the time. It's the contentment that we feel inside. And I heard a lesson the other day, and it was talking about being able to accept whatever state you're in, because your state changes from day to day. So if you can't accept it, then you can't be content.
I think that the word blessed in the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, the word is used, it's often translated happy. And there is that. But I think there's something a little deeper there in that idea of happy is he who is persecuted for righteousness' sake than what we normally consider happiness to be. And that's why I went, there was a, I forget now the guy that has the Crystal Cathedral out in California, he had a series of sermons that he preached on the Be Happy Attitudes. And that's what he called the Beatitudes, the Be Happy Attitudes. But what he was doing is placing too much emphasis upon the physical and material and the idea of having a smile on your face, as he always did. He was Joel Osteen before Osteen showed up. And so that kind of thing, and the contentment and the joy, the peace which surpasses all understanding, all of those things that are present in the life of a Christian are not contingent upon outward circumstances. They're something that come from within and can be present despite the outward circumstances.
I can't quote it, but where it says that the world can't understand the spiritual things, they don't understand a spiritual attitude or being.
They cannot, because their worldly minds, the carnality that's present there.
Understand? Okay, so I had some thoughts, but
sure.
This is from limited experience since I'm the youngest one in the room. So, 3 and 4 connected, the selfish person, and I think about this like with my marriage with Armando, we're the happiest and the strongest when we're looking out for each other instead of me looking out for me and him looking out for him. And I think if everyone were selfish, then we'd be very lonely. There would be no connections with each other, and I think that goes into 4, because the more we get to know each other and the more we're connected with each other, the more we understand that a lot of times there's really not a greener pasture on the other side. Everybody has problems, they're just different problems, and once you understand that, it's just a little bit easier to be content in your own situation and to be satisfied with your own life.
Very good. That's a good point. And you know, you think about that when you apply that to relationships. It's an interesting thing when the Bible refers to the husband-wife relationship as supposedly the closest. Man is supposed to be closer to his wife than even his children, a woman to her husband instead of her children. and even is stated in Scripture as to why that is. A man shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, the two shall become one flesh. But what you find in reality, as far as practice in the world, is that that the parents are going to be fiercely possessive of their children, and that but then they'll grow apart as a couple. So why is that? And I think that the point you made there is very good, because we are selfless with regard to our children. But too often in a marriage relationship, we become selfish. You know, what's in it for me? Why isn't he treating me this way? Why isn't she treating me right? Whereas with your kids, it doesn't matter if your kids mistreat you. They're your kids, and you expect that you're going to be selfless. You're going to treat them well, regardless of whether they return it. Now, let's go macro. Our society. Look what happened down in Houston. Look what happened in Florida. When the trouble came, everybody helped. Everybody all of a sudden became selfless. And because they were selfless, they were getting along. People who in another situation would not speak to one another or would probably have harsh words for one another, well, they were piling into boats together and you know, going through the flooded streets. And everybody got along for a while. And because selflessness leads to that kind of thing, selfishness does not. So the application could be macro or micro. It could be big or small in regard to it. The individual relationships and then the big problems in our culture, it all comes down to selfishness. And there's no ultimate value that is placed on that. It's something that leads to ruin.
And even though talks about being contentment, it was still about his relationship with the Lord. He didn't do it for self-fulfillment, but to please God, and that their relationship was still selfless.
What was his greatest joy at the gift that he received from the Philippians when he was in prison?
Knowing
that they had given it, and that they were blessed because they gave it to him. Yeah. I mean, in other words, he said, I could have gotten by without it. But he rejoiced in the fact that they would benefit.
And you know, about his boasting.
Yeah.
Don't boast.
Yeah.
He boasts in the Lord.
In the Lord. Yeah. So yeah, that selflessness action is something extremely important. Okay. Good. Anybody else? That gets us past that time. So we will be at the phrase where it says, laugh and the world laughs with you, cry and you cry alone.